I'm sorry for the delay, and I think one of the points that I talked about last time was the way in which archaeology changed the whole perspective on the study of the past. And it changed because it brought in supposedly scientific and new inputs, but it also changed because a distinction was made now between art history and archaeology. And so the architecture went into the subject of art history, and archaeology took a very different route and located architecture in terms of conservation, or located architecture in terms of looking at texts and identifying early sites. Now, what I thought I would do here is to move away from that and try and locate the shrine both in the archaeological landscape and also see why, or give an explanation for why, the shrine comes up at a point that it does, which is much later in the life of the history of the subcontinent. Now, just to go back to the first seminar, and just to very briefly point out the ways in which the temple has been studied, there is a disjunction which is accepted between the ideational religion of the Vedas and the bhakti of the Purans. And the temple is said to have taken off from the Puranic bhakti in the 9th and 10th centuries AD. There's also a lot of discussion in historical literature about the role of the Brahmins in introducing theistic traditions, and particularly the fact that this was related to agrarian expansion. And so one sees that the requirements of the state, which then resulted in grants of land to Brahmins, and these Brahmins then set up temples. So in a way, the link has been through the state, as well as through trading networks and agrarian expansion. And in this whole discussion, philosophical trends have taken a back seat, and the focus has been much more on looking at either polity or looking at the economics of it. This is in spite of the fact that when one looks at literature and when one looks at textual references, one finds that the temple is easily referred to already by the 6th century AD as providing an alternative to sacrificial religions.
What would be the Sanskrit for temple?
It's a devale, devagriha. Yeah. So really the abode of the god.
Abode of the gods.
Yeah.
But would that imply a permanent structure?
Yes, I'll come to that somewhat in a moment. Now, there's also the whole discussion in literature, and particularly the writings of Kapila Vatsan, where she sees a kind of continuity from the Vedic Yagya to the building of the temple, and the fact that the Vastu Shastras sometimes follow this up and correspond to the construction of the temple, but not all the time. So the objectives then are, one, to trace the evidence for sacred space, and not just the temple, to define the ways in which sacred space, to define sacred space and what it meant to the community, and secondly, to move on from there. And this I'm going to start with the prehistoric evidence, 10,000 BC. And the second is more specifically the origins of the temple within this archaeological landscape. So the first is just to look at sacred space, when it comes up, what ways it comes up, and to move to the temple only from there. Now, when one looks at sacred space, there are two definitions, or two ways in which this can be defined or termed. One is in terms of places or where which were connected with ritual. So One possibility are platforms in the middle of settlements or other unique images or stones which may have been worshipped. And the earliest evidence that we have for this is fairly early, which goes back to 11,000 BP. The second kind of sacred space are burials, and this again come up as early as 10,000 BC. So we are really looking at in the prehistoric period. We are looking at space A as important spots within a settlement, and B as burials or associated with that the rituals connected with burials. Let me move on to the Harappan civilization and briefly talk about space within the Harappan civilization. The Harappan civilization was discovered in the 1920s. And in a way, what it did was that it pushed back the history of the subcontinent, because prior to the 1920s, the history of religion or the history of the subcontinent really started with discussion on the Vedas. And with this discovery, we now have Indian history starting much earlier, starting in the 3rd, 2nd millennium BC rather than 1500 BC, which was traditionally believed. Now, the study of the Harappan civilization itself has undergone changes, and from the time it was detected to now. It was at that time John Marshall believed that it was a peaceful civilization, but more importantly, that one could trace back Indian traditions and beliefs to the Harappan civilization, to the fact that it really provided the foundation for subsequent belief systems that developed in the subcontinent. This, of course, changed in the 1940s when Mortimer Wheeler had a very different perspective on the civilization. He argued that it was fortified, the kings were despotic kings, and that it was destroyed by Aryan invasions. So the Aryan invasion association with the Harappans is really 1940s. More recently, and recent archaeological work, of course, traces the origins of the civilization to the 8th, 7th millennium BC. It also argues that it was unique, and that there were no influence, or it was not shaped by the Mesopotamian civilization. It was twice the size of the Mesopotamian, but that also it was very diverse, both politically and in terms of economic structures. And when one looks at the extent of the Harappan civilization, one finds that it starts from the northwest and goes down into Gujarat. And certainly within this very vast area, the kind of agricultural systems are very different between Sindh and Balochistan and Gujarat. Also, the point is that there seems to be a movement within the Harappan civilization where the settlements expanded into Gujarat somewhat later, as compared to the sites further up north. So that's Harappa. That is Mohenjo-daro, and we are looking at this region, which is interesting, because while the sites in Gujarat, in terms of the chronology, are somewhat later from those on the Indus, what is quite significant is that it is here that changes take place rather than up in the northwest. And it is in this area that there's continuity in the post-Harappan period. So in terms of what we know of the Harappan civilization in recent years, a great deal has been added, not just in terms of its expanse, but also the way in which the sites functioned and were associated with what was happening elsewhere in the subcontinent. Where's my cursor? Now, if we look at Harappan religion is as diverse as the archaeology that I mentioned. But something which is quite striking is that there are no temples and there's no monumental architecture which is associated with ritual. So there is a fair deal of consensus on that. There's also consensus on the diversity. The second point is that there seems to be a ritual use of water. And again, this is something which keeps coming up again and again when we look at temples. Because often temples are associated with water, with tanks. And water also links the temple not just with ritual, but also with the agriculture, with the community. The other continuity arises in terms of the terracotta images, and I will show you one at this just in a while. It's possible that these were in open-air shrines. We don't know. Fire altars have been found, but there's evidence only at one site, which is Kalibangan in Rajasthan. They, elsewhere, they are looked upon much more as hearths rather than fire altars. And of course, we have burials in separate cemeteries. But what is quite interesting, and again, something which continues for a very long time within the Indian tradition, are the narrative depictions on molded tablets which show offerings to deities. And finally, of course, what we have finds of masks, and it is hypothesized that these would have been, or these would have been used for dramatic enactments. So the point is very clear that there's enormous diversity, but there's no monumental architecture. There are continuities, such as continuities in the use of water or terracotta images, and of course the narrative depictions. This is a typical female terracotta figurine from Mohenjo-daro. Figurines not like this, but figurines of clay, both baked and unbaked, continue to be made and continue to be involved as votive offerings. And also there's ethnographic data that this continues till today. These seals do not continue beyond the Harappan civilization. And again, many of the depictions on the seals, people have argued, reflect later traditions. For example, the yogic posture on this seal, it has been argued that, there's nothing else which that sitting position could possibly depict. Around 1900 BC, there is evidence for a shift in human population in the area that we looked at, referred to as the Harappan civilization, particularly at sites in Sindh and Balochistan. There is a sort of gap between 1900 BC and settlement starts again in the early centuries of the Christian era. At the same time, there is an increase in the number of settlements eastward. That means in Punjab, Haryana, Uttar Pradesh and North Rajasthan. And of course, in Gujarat, there is stability of population. So Gujarat really is the area where things do not change. Let me just very briefly talk about what was happening in other parts of the subcontinent, because certainly the other parts were not buoyant. And in terms of ritual, what comes out quite strongly is the rock art, particularly in central and peninsular India, which is contemporary to the Harappan civilization. And this rock art does show several scenes, several enactments. But what it doesn't show is fights between human beings and killings of humans. though it does show dancing and several animals, wild animals are incorporated in dancing themes. Also, what is quite interesting is that many of these rock art sites have later settlements and continue into a later period. If we look at what is happening archaeologically in the subcontinent between 2000 and 400 BC, there seems to be a broad cultural unity in North India, and it's very different from what is happening in Peninsular India. So there really are two cultural divisions that one can make. In the north, there is a settlement hierarchy, fortified large centers, towns and village settlements. There are also political settlements, and of course we know of the Janapadas, which emerge at this point in time. But the southernmost of this broad cultural unity that we are looking at are really the sites near Sachi and Tripuri. If we contrast this with what is happening, there are two more slides. Just to show you the terracottas from Chandraketugar and the fact that these hair ornaments are found, or terracottas with hair ornaments like these are found all along the Ganga Valley. This would suggest that there was some kind of a shrine within which these terracotta images were placed. Certainly the two pillars connecting an tablature on top. There would also, this is again from Chandraketugar, and does suggest enactments, music, dancing associated with many of the sites in the Ganga Valley. Now, if we contrast this with what is happening in Peninsular India, the settlements are much smaller. There is nevertheless a separation of living and burial space. There is no evidence for monarchy. There are multiple regional centers of control. The burials are largely burials of young adults. And there is a whole variety within these burials. These include not just stone circles, but also dolmens, urn burials, and terracotta sarcophagi. And of course, there are a range of grave goods within these burials. This is the sites. The red dots are the megalithic sites. These are largely in Andhra, Karnataka, and further down Tamil Nadu. Maharashtra doesn't have very many megalithic sites, and really provides a link between what is happening in the north and what is happening further south. That's a megalithic burial. The other kind of evidence that one has at this point are the rock shelters, where there are associations of rock shelters with fertility goddesses, also with the Shivling, of course, is much later, but the rock shelter and the depictions are earlier. Around 317 to 186, what is quite striking is that for the first time, there is a cultural unity in the subcontinent, as indicated by the inscriptions, by the Ashokan inscriptions. And this sort of unity extends from the south way up to the northwest and to the east, from Gujarat to the east. The unifying elements have generally been regarded as political control, but I think we need to look at other kind of unifying elements, which are trading groups and guilds, movements of caravans. And these movements were accompanied by the Brahmins and the Shramanas. We're also looking at script as a unifying element, because even though the languages of the subcontinent are very different, the script is just one script from which all writing originates. And also what is quite interesting is that there is writing on pots and seals. There is evidence for relic worship, pilgrimage, religious festivals, and dancing and music, and dana and merit making emerge very strongly at this point in time. The textual references come from a range of sources. And the Ramayana refers not just to the worship of Vishnu in a shrine, but also to offering of flowers. There are Harmya Prasad, which is really the palace shrine. Similarly, the Dharma Sutras talk about the shrines to gods. And the Arthashastra makes a distinction between the Chaitya and the Devagriha, the Chaityas being outside the city. The other evidence that becomes very strong at this point are the deities on coins. And again, Gujarat provides information which we can contrast to what is happening in the northwest, where certainly by 2nd century BC, deities are depicted on coins. This is the Saurashtra Janapada coins and the Gajalakshmi depicted on one of these coins. But also around the same time, there are references in inscriptions to shrines of Vishnu being set up. This is the famous Heliodorus pillar, which refers to the setting up of a shrine, and the shrine has actually been found in the vicinity of the pillar. If we move further south, the earliest reference to a shrine again comes from Gudimalam, but what we have is a shivling which was placed. This was an open air shrine. Because we have sort of the progression as we know from inscriptions. In the 2nd century BC, the Shivling was set up. 1st to 3rd centuries, a brick temple was constructed around it. By the 9th century, elaborate arrangements had been made for rituals, so the temple had sort of evolved and grown and had incorporated or integrated a range of rituals within it. By the 9th and 10th centuries, there are also inscriptions which record gifts to the temple and certainly bring the temple for the first time within the range of the inscriptional data. And it's only in the 12th century that we have inscriptional evidence for the construction in stone. So a lot of the earlier data comes from archaeological excavations which were conducted within the temple precincts, and it's only through that we have evidence of this progression at this temple. Another site, which I had briefly mentioned last time, but I think provides us very interesting data, is Nagarjunakonda, which has an enormous span, 3rd millennium BC to 16th century AD. It also has a whole range of shrines at the site. There are 30 Buddhist establishments, but also 19 Hindu temples and medieval Jain shrines. If one sees the distribution of the Hindu temples, these are mainly along the river Krishna, while the other shrines are scattered within the valley. But what is also quite interesting is that between themselves, the temples have enormous diversity in plan, though there is sharing of architectural tradition with the Buddhist Chaityas. The temples are both to Shiva and Vishnu, wherever we can identify this. It's not always possible because the icons are hard to find. I talked about the diversity of the Nagarjunakonda temples. So you have single shrines with pillared halls, palace temples. This two shrines and two pillared halls. But what is quite significant is the setting up of pillars in front of temples. And the setting up of pillars, as you know, is goes back to also the Buddhist tradition where you have the Chaitya with a pillar in front. And temples certainly take this on. And the second association, which links up to something which I had said earlier, was the association of water tanks. And I had mentioned that water has had a ritual importance within the subcontinent. The water tank has been found near the Pushpabhadra Swami temple. This is the plan of Nagarjuna Kunda Valley. The temples are all here, located at this site. The megalithic sites are around there. This is the Mahachaitya, and the Buddhist sites are sort of scattered. Many of these are now reconstructed because the valley was submerged when a dam was built on the river. This diversity which we find at Nagarjunakunda is not just limited to Nagarjunakunda, but the diversity is elsewhere as well. So we have tree shrines. These come up largely on monuments. We, of course, it's impossible to find these in the archaeological record. Open-air shrines we know from terracottas, and I refer to the Chandraketugal terracotta plaque. But what comes up and what is quite interesting are the memorial temples, which were built in memory of either a queen or somebody else. And these memorial temples take on that whole tradition of commemorating the dead and of setting up memorials for the dead, except that in this case what is being set up are shrines. There are temples near water bodies, and again at Junagar in Gujarat there is a large tank which is referred to in the Ashokan inscriptions. But by the Gupta period, by the 4th, 5th centuries AD, a Vishnu temple was set up at the site. There is rock-cut architecture in addition to the shrines that I have talked about. This, of course, is a Buddhist Chaitya with a pillar in front. I'm not sure if I can see it in here. But something which I would like to point out when I did mention memorial temples. Now these are memorial stones. The bullock cart at the bottom is supposed to indicate it's not yoked, and that indicates the person who has died. There is an inscription here which mentions the name of the person, sometimes an occupation, and on top, which is broken, there would be a portrait or of either a couple or a man or the person for whom this was set up. Now these particular memorial stones were set up around Buddhist shrines. But I do not have a visual of that, but there are several such memorial stones which were set up all over the place, near temples, away from temples, and there's a whole, the commemoration of the dead takes on a life of its own. To move on, there is evidence for ritual archaeologically, again, as early as 2nd, 1st centuries BC. This again varies. It's not the same from at all the sites. At Nagarjunakunda, of course, it's much more complex, and in addition to circumambulation, there's also indications of abhishek and offerings to the deity. Temples are often associated and are often credited to royalty, but if you look at inscriptions, there's royal patronage at Nagarjunakunda for only 3 out of the 19 temples. The reasons for setting up of the temple are equally varied. you know, sometimes for the king's long life, other times various people in the employ of the ruler set up temples. And what is quite interesting is that a temple which was set up in Andhra should have patrons as far as the west coast, one of them being a Yona Raja. Yona, of course, coming from Ionia, Ionian Greeks, and perhaps either a westerner or a non-local. So the coming together of patrons from different localities to set up a temple in Andhra is also evident in the 3rd century AD. So finally then, what or how does the archaeological data provide us with another perspective on the origin of the temple? I think what is quite significant is the continuity of settlement that the archaeological data provides. Though no doubt I have pointed out shifts and also changes in this. The second aspect or the second insight that archaeological data provides is diversity in the nature of worship and the fact that elaborate temple complexes coexisted with rock shelters, also with much simpler structures. And the fact that rather than looking at the origins of the temple in, I would argue, simply in philosophical traditions, we need to look at it, look at the emergence of the shrine much more within cultural changes and the unifying factors which resulted in a pan-Indian tradition emerging around the 2nd, 1st centuries BC. Thank you. Okay. Just close this. Or?
I'm really fascinated. You don't often get that story told, do you? The sort of the material continuity of these traditions.
Yes, I've worked hard to put it together.
Yes. I thought it was those going right back to the Harappan civilization there. did you didn't mention painted greyware. Is that important?
Are you referring to the Aryan bit? Because painted greyware is a pottery type.
It's pottery type, and there's a continuity. I vaguely remember reading that through the continuity of material culture going through.
Yes, that actually painted greyware occurs in the Ganga Valley, and goes back. You know, if one is looking at continuity within the Ganga Valley, then one would need to go back to the ochre-colored pottery, the OCP. You know, and then you have the painted greyware and the northern black polished ware and so on and so forth. But I think when one, and which is I think quite fascinating, is that when one looks at the material culture and the archaeological data, there seems to be, you know, all parts of the subcontinent are inhabited and take on a different trajectory, but not necessarily are there sort of empty spaces which are occupied or, you know, where people move in. There are changes which happen, but, you know, all parts are quite settled and inhabited.
Throughout the whole period, is
that? Yeah, yeah.
Interesting. And you showed pictures of, like, the seated yogi and the Indus Valley seals. As Asko Parpona was arguing, that actually the seated yogi was like a seated bull, because you get very similar representations in Elamite seals or something, which is a Mesopotamian culture. So I thought that was an interesting observation that he was making there, arguing that it wasn't actually a seated yogi but a seated bull. And the other thing that I thought was interesting, he's, do you know the Indusvani script? Well, he claims as a script that he's been trying to decipher for the last 20 or 30 years, I think. There's some recent thinking that it's actually not a script at all, you know. So he's been wasting his time for the last 30 years.
Because normally what happens is, and you know, the sort of general trend has been, even the Pashupati seal, the general trend is, you know, you look at what is happening later and then sort of try to identify within the Indus, on the Indus seals, whether, you know, it fits or not. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure that's a good way of doing it. And I think that, because, you know, like you said, there are some similarities. You can always find analogies elsewhere. So I thought, I would just do is look at the diversity and see where the continuities are, rather than trying identifications, because to my mind, I think those have advantages and disadvantages.
Right. Yeah. Well, last comment was that I thought it was very interesting that you got this cultural unity, as it were, quite early on within the subcontinent.
Yeah, that's true. Really Mauryan, post-Mauryan, and because, you know, post-Mauryan things just explode, right, as it were,
right,
and lots of things are happening.
So, I mean, the later critique, the one that there's no such thing as Hinduism and so on. Well, that's true in one sense, but you nevertheless can trace a certain continuity of material culture and themes really very early.
Now, whether you call it Hindu or whether you call it whatever else,
They obviously don't have the name there, but there's there's certainly a theme there. Yeah, there's certainly a sense of unity or something. I thought it was very interesting. Or the other thing was that this unity is through writing as well.
That's something which I need to work on. You know, I need to really sort of develop this further. But something which has always struck me is, you know, even when you have Tamil, which is completely different from Sanskrit and Prakrit, you know, the script use is Brahmi.
Yeah.
And again, you know, when one looks at writing, one looks at inscriptions. One doesn't look at these little shards of pottery which have names on them,
right,
and which are all over. And in fact, Mahadevan's work shows that in South India, Brahmi was used not just for Tamil, for Prakrit, Sanskrit, but also for Sinhala. And a lot of the, you know, if you actually plot out the distribution is coastal.
Hmm.
That, of course, links up with my, you know, my other sort of interest in maritime.
But isn't this because it's a foreign import? I mean,
Brahmi?
No, because writing in itself is from a Semitic origin, that the Indian tradition, in fact, was basically oral. So the unity is in the oral, not in the writing. The writing is, in fact, something foreign to the indigenous culture.
I'm not sure. You know, if one looks at the Anuradhapura excavation and the fact that they have dates for these shards going back to pre-Mauryan, I think there's... I know that a lot of scholars are not very happy with the dates and, you know, don't agree. But I think we need to sort of...
But my understanding was through travelling in Central Asia that, in fact, it wasn't something which was indigenous, and that explains why it's around the coastal regions. It's brought in from...
But the coastal are, you know, the east coast, and then... partly Coimbatore, so the distribution is quite odd,
there isn't any continuity. In fact, I mean, it's the same argument with the Brahmi script. I think that, you know, the difficulties with the continuity argument are so complex, and so, as you say, but a long history in itself. You know, whereas it was fallacious in the archaeological evidence that, as you mentioned, the discoveries from the 1920s, when you sort of rationalised
sort of retrospectively, you know, they were far too quick to assume that there was some sort of continuity between religious beliefs through these seals that you mentioned, whereas they could easily be. In fact, if you looked at civilizations, river civilizations in other parts of the world, they could easily be explained in that way. They had much more in common, in fact, with things outside rather than inside the subcontinent. And I think, you know, your argument is excellent on the diversity, as you say, and various different traditions overlaying and taking over and absorbing. That's, I mean, undoubtedly that's a powerful argument, but equally that, you know, it's a different thing to saying that there's continuity within those traditions which go back in a linear historical fashion. In other words, that you know, the what was called the Vedic tradition didn't have a tradition of temples. You know, that's why I was questioning right from the beginning. You know, you had, as came through with Stahl's reenactment of Vedic sacrifice, they had something there and they burnt it and it was disposed of and there's nothing left. And there's no actual archaeological evidence of temple building. And the whole sort of the religious culture doesn't necessitate it. It's a religion of sacrifice and so forth. It's not dependent on a settled population or temple building deities. You know, it's a completely different way of expressing their spirituality, religiosity. In the same way you've got, you know, the Buddhist traditions and then the Hindu traditions, which come chronologically later anyway. I mean, we can't dispute that. But to say that there's this sort of link then between, which can be, if you like, discrete, but certainly traditions which are whole within themselves, but there are so many sort of gaps and differences that they are the ones that stand out rather than looking for the continuity, as you say, even in a cultural, from a cultural point of view. Again, you know, you have to be having a kind of ideological reason to project that in order, again, to sort of see it in retrospect. It's like when you go to the Swami Narayan temple and they give you this sort of chronology going back from Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, but in fact it's fallacious. You know, yes, you want to see that. I mean, because they've got political or ideological reasons for that, we can understand that. But then to actually say that, you know, this is fact, this is true, it doesn't hold up.
You're balancing it with the individuality
why can't we accept disjunction? We hate lacunae, I know that. And we have to fill in, you know, whether it be a chronological sequence. We don't like the fact that, you know, there's a civilization here which we can't explain in terms of later civilizations. But from your point of view, you know, what is your cultural? Why are you wanting
to do this?
To produce a cultural unity between Harappan, Vedic.
I didn't bring in the Vedas. Sorry,
I know you didn't. I know you left. You left it.
I didn't
for whatever reason. But you know what is?
Why am I doing this?
What is motivating you?
Yeah.
To rewrite, if you like,
history,
or to attempt a different model, if you like, that we see it differently.
Yes, you know what I'm. What does concern me, and which I think is the reason why I'm doing this, is that there are lots of studies which look at textual traditions. All right, I mean this has gone on for a very long time. All right, now these studies of even when one is studying, you know, Buddhist philosophy or the coming up of theistic traditions, never, ever talk about a temple. You know, the temple is only there for art and architecture or is only there as, you know, sculptures, you know, in museums, whatever else. And surely you would agree, that's not a very good way of doing it, you know.
I can empathise
with
that. I empathise with that part.
Yes.
You know, I'm fully support you in the fact that you're looking at art, history, architecture, religion, religious studies, trying to get a holistic view,
yes,
and cross-disciplinary,
yes,
interdisciplinary. I think,
yes,
that's quite laudable.
Yes.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Okay,
but
now the second point, to go on with that and to argue. And then again, when I'm talking of continuity, maybe I should look for another word, because continuity, you're right, creates this kind of a suggestion, as if I was trying to push back
individuality of each,
or the fact that it's become a very politicized argument, mm, the original inhabitants,
sure,
and the Aryan culture,
yeah,
which I think all are very misleading. Now the second point, which I feel very strongly about, is the diversity,
mm,
and the fact that whenever we look at an identity for India, we're looking at one identity. It never was there, and it's impossible even to think or to suggest. Leading on from there, I think, is the whole notion of conflict within the Indic tradition. And I think that and particularly religious conflict. I'm not talking just in terms of people going to war with each other. But I think that notion of religious conflict, again, is a kind of colonial or a European or a Christian way of looking at religion in unitary terms,
yes,
which is then transplanted. So if I were to now break away from all these positions, argue for diversity, argue for coexistence, argue for the fact that there are, if you look at religion, you need to look at cultural traditions, and the fact that certainly from 2nd, 1st centuries BC, there's a continuity of cultural tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happens before that, I agree. I cannot trace it further back. And I myself said that the northern and the southern tradition are very different, in the first millennium BC. Now, where does the Harappan fit in? And I do not really want to get into the Aryans and the Vedic tradition. Because I think that we need to get out of that this sort of oppositional aspect that we've got into, and look at texts and archaeology as at times parallel, at times interpenetrating, at times influencing each other, because that's a no-win situation. The Aryan, whether they were Harappans or not, or whatever else they were, and my ideology is that we need, mm, to take archaeology into account when we are doing,
yeah,
any study of the past of the subcontinent.
Mm.
So I hope that takes care of the objections that you raise. And certainly, I'm not trying to say that we need to push the temple back to the Harappan period.
Mm.
But I also think that we need to take into account the fact that, you have water, or importance of water, which,
well,
I'm not sure.
These could be universal.
It's not there in Mesopotamia,
features.
And it's not there in Egypt. You certainly have the river, but, the tanks become... again, when you look at the... there's not that much that's made out of baked brick.
Mm.
But then tanks are. And why? If they're not important. You can get water many ways. Why do you have to spend time, energy making these huge baked brick tanks if it's just a question of getting water,
for purification purposes?
Mm. So I think there's something there, but and certainly from the 2nd-1st centuries BC, I think the cultural unity onwards, and the fact that we're not looking at Buddhism decline, then came Hinduism, then Hinduism or whatever else declined and came something else, and there were the Shaivs and the Vaishnavs and the sectarian differences, and I think we need to cut across those.
Why did you? Why are you so specific about the age burials? You gave an age on some of the human burials of something like 1734.
Ah, okay. No, one of the points I was the argument I was making was that not everybody was buried. You know, so it's not it's not a disposal of the dead.
But it was a certain age group.
It was a certain age group. So it already had. We don't know why, because you know we don't. There's no written records and there's so much diversity in the grave goods that you cannot say, you know, if one sees life expectancy as being lower, you know, then one might argue, okay, these were warriors or these were, you know, people who. It's very hard to do that because the grave goods are so diverse. You know, somewhere you'd have a horse burial and armor and so on. In other places, you would have something completely different. Mm-hmm. So there's no way I can do that. But the reason why I pointed it out was that, you know, it was not just something that, you know, a person dies and you have to do something with the body. Mm-hmm. But there were only a few people who were buried, not everybody.
That's interesting.
And the fact that, again, when we look at, religious traditions, we never ever look at disposal of the, you know, or burials or memorial stones or, you know, how these related to temples or shrines. And I think that was something, that was the second link that I was trying to sort of work out between burials, you know, fairly early, and then how it moves through time and how it keeps recurring, you know. Even when it's cremation, you know, the Jain saints, for example, you have their memorials because they just stood there and died or, you know, let the life go away. And then you have these stones.
Yeah.
So I think there is this, at least to my mind, it seems that there is this tradition which keeps coming, you know, again and again in whatever form. And goes back a very long time. But, you know, you don't find it in texts. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Only Vedic hymn which seems to indicate cremation, I think.
Surely there were other means, because not everybody who died had a burial. So certainly there are other means. So I'm not sure, you know. And cremation doesn't leave any evidence. So one doesn't know about that. But it's quite interesting the way, you know, this memory or, you know, enshrining the memory keeps coming back again and again, and right through the historical period. And again, I think I'm not sure. I think that's, again, there are differences with what is happening elsewhere. And
you have snake temples as well, don't you? Further
at Mathura, so Naga temples.
Different again.
Are they both men and women who are buried in this age group, 17 to 30?
Yes. But there are no I've tried hard to sort of juggle around the data and to see any patterns, and it's very hard to see what, because there's just so much. And also the fact is that, you know, these are fractional burials. So at times it's extended inhumation, but other times the bones are collected and are put back in these burials. So they are coming back, you know, so it's a spot. And that's something which I'm not sure if it would tie in, you know, this whole notion of territory, of space, of the fact that you identify, because, you know, why else would you want to come back? So there are sites where people are coming back and using it over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So basically, you know, what I was trying to do is that we need to sort of move beyond
Definitely.
Just looking
Make
at
links.
Religion in a kind of linear way to looking at this whole range and the fact that you know, the evidence is just so diverse.
What were the dates of those burials again?
The dates, the earliest are 1400 BC, and it goes on. See, we don't have dates till the end of it, because under Amravati, one of the stupas at Amravati, there is an urn burial, but we don't know when this was built. So generally, they come up to about 2nd, 1st centuries BC, but then it changes again. You know, you start getting those memorial stones from around that time. So the burials are contemporary to the painted grey ware and all that's happening in the north. So I hope...
I thought it was very interesting when you had the picture of the Nagarjuna Konda Valley, where you get this idea that you can clearly see from the work you've done through the diversity that it's a sort of sacred landscape there, so that whoever, at whatever time, creates some sort of memorial or structure or something which indicates or that the place itself is has a sort of sacred numinous quality in itself.
It's quite a stunning landscape, that river valley.
Yes.
It's very wide, isn't it? There's a bridge that goes across it. It's a vast river.
Because as you say, the danger is that historians will just see it as a Buddhist and not, as you say, look at the bigger picture.
No, that's
you know, as soon as you mention it, you know, your mind thinks, a Buddhist site.
Yes.
Whereas, as you say, there's a lot more there than first meets the eye.
Well, thanks very much. I think we should nevertheless give you a...
No, thank you, and I'm sorry for all the delays, but finally, thanks to Remford.
And there's one more actually, isn't there? On 17th of November.
Yes, if people are still willing to listen.
The biography of temple complexes.
I'm going to take this forward and see what I do with the with the temple from the 6th.
That's not part of this series. That's
yes.
It's a seminar or a lecture.
Yeah, seminar.
It's a seminar.
It's a seminar. Technically, a seminar, but I think. 17th of November, Thursday, week 6, 2 p.m. So do come along to that if you can.
No, thank you very much. That
thank you for having it up.
That was
no, because
really
that's something which I'm working on, and I'm, you know, it's always nice to have people who are convinced or not convinced, because then it helps me think whether I'm, you know, I should sort of pursue this line of argument or do something else. Or
I sort of got too stuck in the compartments, which you said earlier on. We said this before when we met.
Yeah.
It's really necessary to be lateral. I think so. I find it really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I did too.
Thank
it's
you.
It's incredibly complex, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I should try and make that next one.
So we'll have to see next time. I think I'm going to do something else rather than this gives me...
Well, it worked in the end, didn't it? So,
you mean I should sort of persevere?
No, I think so,
You know, in this area, you've got a visual example.
I don't know what to do.
Okay. So next time...
I'll be a bit earlier than that.
All right, so I think I should... continue with this. No, but that's true, because otherwise it's too much up in the air. And
yeah, the only thing, I don't know why it fell off in the middle.
But you kept going. Thank you. It really does open up. What do you think about that?
Oh, okay, thanks. So I'm on the right track, then, hopefully.
Well, I'm also into the Mesopotamian connection in any case.
I don't know enough on that, and you know, but it's I think Mesopotamian culture takes on a completely different trajectory, as it were.
Totally.
The temple there is extremely important, which it is not in the Harappan.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you catch the Metropolitan take on that about 2 to 3 years ago when they did the big exhibition over there on all of this, on the Harappan and the Mesopotamian? And they really did do a really good job. So that was good to see that in there. Thank you.
What's that? That looks
interesting.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I know. Yes.
Maybe you can have your
wife. I haven't studied with John Marr at SARS.
Bye-bye.
Yeah,
bye. See you.